Welcome to Alexify, the place for fashion. This week, I am joined by an award-winning activist, speaker, and author. Please join me in extending a warm Alexify welcome to Shia Vestida. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am so good. So you moved to New York City in 2015 when your parents got a job at the Center for Earth Ethics, which connects individuals and groups through four areas of focus: sustainability and global affairs, environmental justice and civic engagement, indigenous wisdom, values and rights, and ecology, spirituality, and faith. With your parents' involvement in this organization, were you exposed to this type of work at an early age? And what was that kind of like?
Yeah, so my parents actually met at a climate conference in 1992, where they were like in their 20s. And my mom is from Chile, my dad is from Mexico. And like 10 years before I was born, they were already part of the climate movement. They were already organizing. They were already kind of doing what I do today, which is going to all of these conferences and meeting new people and making new connections. So definitely my parents are just like lifelong environmentalists. It's not even a title they have for themselves. It's a way of being and a way of seeing the world. So this center was what brought us to New York. It was the way in which I would say my life completely changed, because in Mexico, there isn't the same opportunities for the climate movement to have this global stage. So when I moved to New York, I understood that I had to take advantage of the opportunity of having a global stage and being able to use that platform in order to put the message of climate justice at the forefront. Because in the United States, the message had mostly been around kind of traditional environmentalism, conservation, and even Earth Day is all about that. It's about how do we get areas protected? But the question never was, how do we protect ecosystems and communities? How do we make sure that people are safe? How do we frame the climate movement as a health movement, as a equality, justice movement, etc.? So that transition that my parents had to the United States definitely broadened the audience that the climate justice movement had for me. And it allowed me to be really, really active in ways that probably I couldn't have been in any other place.
That's so cool. That's such a great experience into coming into this kind of industry. I think it's so cool that's how your parents met. That's just what a love story. I love that. So in New York, you were in the Administration Committee of People's Climate Movement, in which you organized a 2-month-long activism training program. What did this program kind of entail, and is it still available for people?
So the People's Climate Movement, they organized one of the biggest marches in the United States in 2014. It was hundreds of thousands of people marching to bring attention to the climate crisis. And it was a really monumental march because a lot of celebrities showed up. So it's a lot of people were able to connect to environmental efforts because these public figures were showing up. And People's Climate Movement as an organization is a convener. They don't necessarily do things, campaigns themselves. They bring all of these environmental groups together and they steer the direction, what policy they're going to advocate for, what they're going to shop for. And I started going to these meetings in New York, just kind of seeing how to get involved, really trying to make sure I knew how to be part of a movement outside of the walls of my school. Like, you can join the environmental club, you can join all of these very small efforts, but I really wanted to be a citywide organizer because I thought that's where we could make the most impact. And I went to one of these meetings, you know, in a building that somebody had rented out, and everybody was 50 years or older. And it's because the people who have the time to be environmental activists are usually already retired or it's part of their job. But it's not something that our generation felt really drawn to or invited in. So I just decided I was going to go every single Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. and just sit there and listen. And it was incredible. It was truly, I was seeing actual grassroots organizing in person. It's not, you don't share this on your story, you know what I mean? You just take notes and think, and how can we make sure that this includes youth, includes high schoolers, includes college students? And because I kept showing up as the only like little girl just like taking notes, they invited me to be the youth representative at PCM, People's Climate Movement. And it was my first ever leadership position that I had outside of school, which I was the leader of the environmental club. But I think that shows the importance of that established movements give this sense of leadership to newcomers, because then it makes us feel that our thoughts matter and our initiatives matter. And that's how I started the activism training program, because I knew that being an activist is such a like a mystery. Like, what is it? What does it mean to be an activist? How do you get into organizing? A lot of people think it's only going to marches, not necessarily the background work and the emailing and the newsletter writing and the press releases. And I wanted to, over 2 months over the summer, bring people together in New York, whoever wanted to sign up, to be trained on how, what does it mean to be an activist? How do you get trained on civil disobedience? How do you train on messaging? How do you get somebody from the media who tells you how to tell your climate story? How do you talk to businesses that don't seem to want to change? And it was just for the duration of those 2 months leading up to the climate strike of 2019, which brought out 300,000 people to the streets of New York. So it was my way of gifting my peers and myself, because I also didn't know much of this information, knowledge, resources, because that's usually what's lacking, actually making those connections.
I think that's amazing, and I think it's so interesting that you said that you were attending it and there were so many, older people and you were like the only young person. And I feel like that's so common. Like I didn't really learn about sustainable fashion or just even like never really heard that term up until like 4 years ago. And then when I learned about the truth behind so many of these industries, I was like, whoa, I really need to change what I focus on. I'm not going to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the change. And I feel like we're in such a great time to be alive because there are so many people in our generation that are fighting for our environment. And I think that's amazing. But at the same time, there's so many young people in elementary school and middle school and high school and whatever, not learning about how these industries are affecting our planet. So I think it's so good that you were able to start this at a young age and be kind of like a representative for other young people who want to learn about this and want to get involved in things like this. And now we're seeing that so many young people and so many people in our generation are doing this. So I just think that's amazing. Starting them young, as they say. So before you moved to New York, you grew up in central Mexico. How did your experience growing up there impact the way you look at the climate crisis?
I grew up in a small town called San Pedro Tultepec. It's about, depending on traffic, either 3 hours or 30 minutes from Mexico City. Mexico City is in a big valley, and then the next valley over, it's another big city called Toluca. And my town is kind of in the middle. We're around 2,300 meters above sea level, so it's really, really high altitude. And my town, because of the proximity to Mexico City, it's just a place where, the outskirts of cities are usually places of extraction, extractivism, a lot of factories to supply the city. And that's what it is. That area is one of the largest industrial areas in the country. And I had no idea that about this. Like, growing up, my town is very small, and the industrial area is spread out across multiple towns and the full kind of geographical area in the middle. And my town, we have access to a beautiful lagoon, and my parents, their whole careers in Mexico revolved around making it a protected area. So now it's an actually La Laguna de Chimaleapan is an actually protected area. But we have a river that's one of the most polluted in the continent because of all of the pollutants that go from all of these factories. And we also, our aquifer decreases about 1 meter per year for the past 90 years. So that's why we hear things of Mexico City sinking and all of these things, because the rate of extraction is so, so intense. And so I had this upbringing of a lot of mixed messages, where part of it was, look at how this beautiful lagoon that we have, this beautiful place that my family, my community has fought so hard to protect. And also, a lot of our identity comes from it, like our history of creation. Our history of why there's so much life in that lagoon is because there was a siren that when she brushed her hair, all of life came out of it. And that's so beautiful. And the contrast is these huge factories where we produce, I'm saying we because a lot of the people in my town have to work for these factories for economic reasons. And we produce auto parts, food, like all of the worst snacks, and a lot of there's a town, neighboring town that produces shoes, and we each pick the thing because we had to transition out of our traditional ways of being and connecting with our landscape and our ecosystem. And when you have this tension between connection to nature, but also pollution and extractivism, plus when I was 13, my hometown flooded, all of a sudden there's a wake-up call. That the climate crisis, it also is this ice melting kind of global phenomena that just gets the earth warmer. But it is also very, very localized and seen in the ways in which corporations have made profit off of destruction. And if you take a step back, it's actually insane. Like somebody said, nature destroyed is more valuable than nature protected. Somebody said, this pollution creates wealth rather than beauty creating wealth. And when we look at it from, when I look at it from that perspective, I realize that's not the type of world I want to live in. So growing up in that context shaped me and what I want to fight for, which is a world free from pollution, free from extractivism, where communities can really connect to their land, and that's okay. You don't have to live in a super developed city to be considered wealthy. Because wealth also is traditional ecological knowledge. Wealth is a connection to nature. Wealth is circular economies and circular systems.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think it's so cool that you've lived in these different places. So they've had such an impact on why you are fighting for our planet, and you have these different experiences to base off of. So that's really incredible. You attended your first United Nations Climate Conference in February of 2017. What did you learn from this experience?
That conference was the first time that I found my voice. Like, I was a very outspoken child. I obviously cared about Mother Earth a lot, and I grew up with that concept of Mother Earth. And when I was in kindergarten, I got a little tag that said water protector, and I was in charge of closing all of the faucets when my classmates finished washing their hands. So I always had this ingrained in me, but I never thought I could speak to a group of people and communicate this. But my dad is a storyteller. He's a speaker. He has been going to the UN to talk about indigenous rights for a really, really long time. And so he was invited to this conference in Malaysia, like across the world. And he said, you know, I can't go because I have some scheduling issues, but how about my daughter takes my place instead? I was 15 and he came to me one day. He's like, oh, he actually called me to his room. Shia, come over. Like, I have a question for you. And I'm just like, what's up? And he's like, do you want to go to this UN conference and speak on my behalf? And it's one of those moments where, like, your whole world just kind of shifts a little bit and you ask yourself, like, obviously, it's very hard with school. Like, I'm going to have to miss a lot. I need to catch up. And I was a very, like, studious kid. And then part of you is like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. Like, I have to say yes. So I told him, sure, I'll go. And so I don't, it was in February, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, February. And I just took this plane across the world from New York to Malaysia. And when I got off the plane, they said, the organizers picked me up and said, your panel is actually right now. So you don't even have time to get ready or anything. We have to go now. So I show up to the room and everybody's like, the panel is in the front, the room is full of people, and they just quietly take me to the front and they're like, oh, we were waiting for you. It's your turn. I did not even have notes. I was sweaty off, like, I don't know, 17 hours of travel. And I just grabbed a little, what's it called, microphone. And I talked about what I knew because I didn't know what else to talk about because I hadn't really prepared. So I talked about the lack of climate education in schools. I talked about the importance of indigenous knowledge in decision making. I brought up this example that even, for example, with solar panels and the renewable energy revolution, if we made all of these solar panels with microplastics and disposable, we were still perpetuating a lot of these systems of waste creation. And it's just, I talked about my community and the water extraction and things sinking and this university that was built and literally sank because the architects didn't listen to the indigenous community from the area. And I finished, and then somebody asked me, like, how long did it take you to write this speech? And I was shocked because I hadn't prepared. Like, my preparation, I guess, was lifelong, just listening to my parents speak and me being a little sponge absorbing all of their stories. And then I got invited to two other sessions to address more UN people. And it was in that moment where I realized that adults could say the same thing that I was saying, but it was because I was a young person that we have a moral authority to speak on climate change, a moral authority to speak about the future. And we have the right to be upset that these things aren't being taught to us. So when I went back to New York, I decided I wanted to be really, really involved in the climate space. I wanted to show other youth that they had voices too. And I wanted to take advantage of that experience that I had just had in and feel empowered to be a climate activist. And that's what I did. And ever since I was 15 years old in 2017, I haven't stopped.
That is incredible. That story, I don't know if I, after a 17-hour flight, could just get off and make a speech in which someone thinks is so good that I prepped it. So, round of applause for you. That's incredible, especially at the age of 15. But I mean, that's so true though. It's like we can prepare a speech, but you know this topic, and you are talking just about like your experiences and other people's experiences, like your parents' experiences. And so this is something that you've lived through and seen, and you can just talk about it. And that's just really amazing. That's just wow. I am shocked. Well, after attending that conference, you won the Spirit of the UN Award in 2018. Can you tell us about what this award is and what winning it like felt like and what it entails?
So I was 16 at the time, so it had been 1 year after my UN intervention. And by this point, I had organized my school to go to Albany multiple times. I was already part of People's Climate Movement. I had already established a network across the city to connect youth with organizers and create this network where whenever they ask me, we need three full buses of high schoolers to go to Albany and lobby for this climate legislation, we could get that done. And at the same time, because of my parents' long-standing involvement in the UN as activists, they just asked, who's this girl who had spoken at this place? And my dad is like, oh, that's my daughter. And they, I guess, wanted to recognize the courage that it had taken for a young girl to go up and say those things. So for me, it was an amazing moment because the UN is obviously something that we all grew up hearing about. And I was interested in the UN. I joined Model UN. But you know how Model UN is? Everybody's just like fighting to be the best delegate, fighting for the awards. I was so scared of being part of Model UN. Every time I went to the Model UN conferences, I wouldn't say anything because I felt that nobody there actually wanted to make the world better. They just wanted to argue the best. So it was super uncomfortable to be at Model UN. But at the actual UN, people actually listened. And I felt it was easier for me to speak at the UN than at Model UN. I don't know. I feel like this just shows the difference between what real involvement of youth in these systems that can be at times very bureaucratic, like the role that this conscious involvement has on empowering us. So that award was the first one I ever got. That's like a big deal award. Like I had gotten, I think, one math award at this one math competition before. That was like the only thing I had. And I'm not good at math anymore, so thank God I was for a little bit. But yeah, I felt very validated and I felt like I was on the right path. And I think that's why it's so important to create these systems of recognition for activists to tell us that we're being seen and recognized and we have to keep going.
Yeah, that's crazy. What a turn of events from going to a math award to the sphere of the UN award. That's really impressive. But this is not the only award that you have won for your work as a climate justice activist. The others include Forbes Changemaker Award, Elle Woman of Impact, Time 100 Next, Hispanic Heritage Award, Harper's Bazaar Arc Icon, Most Likely to Save the Planet, Refinery 29, Global Voices Arctic Angels Award, and again, the Sphere of the United Nations Award. And you are only 21, so that's really impressive. Congratulations. You are clearly passionate about what you do, but this is a very heavy topic to be involved in. How do you avoid burnout, or as many of us environmentalists, or just people interested in the world at all experience climate anxiety. So how do you work through that?
Activist burnout is, I mean, in this world where we have to split ourselves into so many sides, we have to be good family members and good friends and good students, and we have to work. I think all of us are susceptible to burnout. So it's not just because of activism, but I have gone to over 150 gatherings over the past 4 years. Like, I think last year I was in 21 or 22 different countries. Like, the amount of traveling, the amount of organizing, of engagement that we need to undergo as activists that are not only working locally, but also globally, because I was at the last four climate conferences, the Conference of the Parties, the COPs, where the Paris Agreement came out of. And this happened every year, it changes. It was in Madrid, then the next year it was in Scotland, then the next year it was in Egypt. This past one was in the UAE, in Dubai. And because it's a global topic, we just have to be everywhere to put pressure on these countries. And that takes a huge toll on activists who are in school, who are working, and who are also trying to be there and be present and have effective campaigns. So the first experience I had of burnout was actually in high school, where I was taking a test in my history class and I just collapsed to the ground. Like, it was actually burned out. Like, I could not take it anymore. And I went to the doctor and they said, there's nothing wrong with her, but she has heart palpitations because of the amount of stress that she has. And it was kind of a reality check for me, because taking care of the planet should not mean sacrificing your well-being. And my dad had told me many times, when you take care of yourself, you take care of the world. And when you take care of the world, you take care of yourself, which is this principle of reciprocity that we have in all indigenous communities across the world. Reciprocity with our communities, reciprocity with our families, with our circles, reciprocity with the land, and reciprocity with yourself. So I decided I needed to shift the way in which I showed up and the way that I acted and the way that I took care of myself. And obviously, it's a process, not one day, because I ended up in the hospital from how much activism I was doing that was going to change the patterns that I had already fallen into, which is like staying up really late, traveling a lot, living on a train, basically. So it's been a process, but the way in which I avoid it now is by very consciously making sure I hit all of my daily targets of basic needs. Like, I need to eat 3 times a day. I need to drink 2 liters of water. I need to sleep 8 hours. I need to, like, all of these things that we all know we need to do in our daily lives, but we don't do, and we forget, or we think something is more important. And being in a global movement, a lot of the times we have to have calls at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. to accommodate our fellow activists in the Pacific Islands, our fellow activists in Asia. So sometimes we do have to make sacrifices, but it's about those sacrifices being spread out so that it's not so much burden on one individual person. And it's also about creating networks so that when you have to step out, the thing doesn't collapse, the movement doesn't collapse. And that's the special thing about movements. If we build deep-rooted networks, we can rely on each other, and we don't have to, any one of us, pool all the work. So I would say having these daily rituals that you stick to is super important. And also actually going outside, sitting on whatever access to nature you have, whether that I wish I had access to the ocean, for example, but like any forest, any park, any grass, and reminding yourself, regrounding yourself, reconnecting with the reason why you want to protect this planet. For me, it's to honor my ancestors that have done so much to collect all of this traditional ecological knowledge, but also to respect and honor future generations. We have this saying that says, we do not inherit the land from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. So I see myself as taking care of Mother Earth to hand it over, not for myself, not for us, not for whatever concept of wealth creation coming from extractivism entails. It is truly an intergenerational way of being.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I'm sorry that happened that you I actually have a very similar story. I was like taking a final the other day and I was midway through my final and I literally fainted and I was like, oh, maybe I should calm down.
Yeah.
But whatever, it is what it
It's
is.
part of the culture, right? It's like, oh, just do all your work, like you'll be
Yeah.
fine later, or grind, or like all of these things. And it's like, no, that's not how we're supposed to treat our bodies.
No, completely. I think this is a whole different topic that I could talk about for hours, but I always think it's so crazy that we're supposed to like know what we want to do for the rest of our life when our brain's not even fully developed. Like society is like, you need to get this job and go to college and do this and also have 8 jobs and do this and this and this. And I'm like, whoa, I need to breathe. So I completely understand. And I think that this is not something that just you and I have dealt with. I think so many people are dealing with it. But I also think it's great that we are breaking this stigma around mental health and that it's much more normalized in nowadays to take mental health breaks or take a day off when you need one and really prioritize your mental health. And I think that you have to care for people's basic needs, because that's included in caring for our environment, like how you said your dad was saying to you. So I completely agree. So you are also one of the lead organizers for Fridays for Future NYC. Can you explain what this is and what impact you've seen as a result?
So I'm not in that position anymore because I don't live in New York anymore. But when I was living in New York and the Fridays for Future movement exploded internationally in basically, like, I don't know, over 100 countries in the world, it was a truly exciting time. Imagine, because I had already been part of People's Climate Movement. I was already organizing my school, and you see nothing changing. You see the politicians like, oh, such cute kids who are involved. And then, like, Greta Thunberg gets on all of these news outlets and she's calling out all of these world leaders. And then she says, and we're having a global climate strike on, I think it was March 15th, the first one, March 15th, 2019. And I just got so excited because I thought, finally, it's happening. We are doing different things to actually call attention to the magnitude of the crisis that we feel. And I organized my high school. 600 kids walked out, which the freshmen weren't allowed to walk out, so that was actually like a really, really big number that we had. And it was really difficult. We had to plan it for a long time. We had to go to each advisory to give a little explanation of the strike. But the tactic that worked best was making it like a cool thing, like making it like an underground kind of gossip thing where we would say, "Oh, are you like going to that thing on Friday? Are you like gonna walk out on Friday?" And that made it so much cooler than, "Hi guys, do you care about the environment? Walk out with us." We had to make it a like an underground like feeling that people were part of something big and it was rebellious. And it worked. And 5,000 students from New York congregated together in Columbus Circle. And that's where I met all of these other incredible organizers from each of the high schools, which have over 500 high schools in New York. And not all of them were involved, but I met a lot of the organizers from the really big schools like Stuyvesant and Brooklyn Tech and LaGuardia. These are like the huge, huge schools that, you know, thousands of students go to. And so we all got together and we were a group, I think at the beginning of like 8 people, like meeting together at this basement of this building that had lent us the space. And we were just trying to figure out how do we organize for this upcoming global climate strike in September. How do we make it the biggest ever mobilization that New York has ever seen? And that's when we started plugging into other networks, asking adult organizations to help us out with funding and managing the funds, because we didn't know how to manage money to fundraise, to pay for the permit and to pay for the stage and to pay the marshal volunteers that were trying to help us. We didn't know how to do media. We didn't know how to do any of it. We just had the passion. And it worked. And from the first strike, which was in March, to September, we were able to bring together 300,000 people to the streets and 7.2 million across the world. So I hope to live in another moment as exciting as that one. But imagine walking through Wall Street with hundreds of thousands of people and you're seeing change, you know, you're feeling change, you're feeling the pavement trembling, and it's just a huge moment of community building.
That's so incredible. I'm not from New York. I'm from Washington, D.C., but I live in Los Angeles now where I go to school. And I'm always seeing, especially like around Earth Month or Fashion Month, I see a lot of like protests happening in New York. And I'm always like so jealous because I'm like, dang, maybe I should have moved to New York instead. But I think it's just so incredible seeing things like that. We're really making noise, and it's just incredible to see it. And whether it's on social or on news articles, because both of those are having huge impacts. And I find that social media is such a big way of people getting educated about this specific topic nowadays. And so that's just incredible. But you also co-founded ReEarth Initiative, which is an international youth-led organization that focuses on highlighting the intersectionality of the climate crisis. Where did this idea of this organization come from, and can you tell us a little bit more about it?
So we wanted to organize an even bigger strike for Earth Day of 2020, but because of the pandemic, we had to cancel everything. And it was a really hard moment for the movement because we were on every single newspaper. Everybody was talking about the youth climate strikes and the youth climate movement. And we were shut down, all of us, in the blink of an eye. And I didn't want our momentum to stop there. So I decided to just call up my friends from across the world and ask them if they wanted to do an Earth Day campaign. And we started a campaign to engage people. And we decided at the end of the campaign that it had been so successful, we actually wanted to turn it into an organization. So that's where ReEarth Initiative came from. It started as kind of a crazy project idea. And it turned into now an organization that has representation in 27 countries, prioritizes youth from the global south, and an intersectional approach to the way that we do climate activism. We have values of inclusivity, of intersectionality, of intergenerational cooperation, and we also want to resource the youth movement, whether that be through actual knowledge and translation, accessibility, toolkits, webinars, and also actual money and projects that youth can use to, and frontline communities can use to do whatever they want in terms of ecosystem restoration, community building. So last year we gave out $250,000 in 46 small grants to make sure that the communities at the grassroots are benefiting from the resources that are coming into the climate movement, which is almost nothing. Like, out of all of global philanthropy, around 2% goes to the environmental movement, and 0.76% goes to youth-led environmental organizations. So we get nothing of the pie of philanthropy. And with government, I don't know if the government is giving anything to youth climate organizations, but you know, with the IRA, for example, that's a big step. But yeah, we just want to make sure that our communities are resourced and they have the support they need to change the narrative and draw down the carbon in the atmosphere, build community, and just empower the movement beyond people on the streets, but actually changing materially on the ground.
That's so amazing. So, you are also a notable speaker, as we've mentioned a little bit about, but you have spoken alongside Leonardo DiCaprio, Jane Fonda, Al Gore, Greta Thunberg, Mary Robinson, and the list just keeps going on. What was that like? And what does it mean to see your name alongside some of these big names in the climate sphere?
Well, I consider myself to be a storyteller and a communicator. And it obviously comes from my dad, my community, my grandparents, who were just always telling stories, whether that be about the mermaid in our lagoon or the way in which governments were failing to come together on climate policy internationally. And I just have a passion to connect with people and meet people where they're at, because I think in the climate space, we wait for people to have their own personal story where they realize that the climate crisis is a thing and then they want to be connected. But it usually creates this very intense feeling of almost desperation of when you first find out the gravity of the crisis. And we don't want people to come into the movement scared or only angry, because anger is also a good fuel for action. But if we do everything in an angry way, we're gonna build an angry world. So I choose to come from it with very deep philosophy of all of the indigenous teachings that I have gotten. And part of it is this stubborn optimism, is like how Cristina Figueres likes to call it. And it's this feeling that we have to be optimistic about the way in which we can change the world, because we have done it many, many times before. And I think that type of messaging is what people need to hear, that we are change agents, we have agency, we want to know what the future looks like, we need to look at our actions right now. And thanks to that storytelling that I bring, plus the views from the youth climate movement, plus the indigenous values that are so important to build a new world, I think I have been just able to come into these spaces, and I'm really grateful for it. I'm really grateful that somebody heard me speak one time and said, I want to have her speak at my thing. And I want to have her, you know, like that's how it happens. You go to one thing, and then another person notices you, and they have you speak at their thing. And all of a sudden, I get an email from Global Citizen saying, by the way, you're going to speak with Leonardo DiCaprio. And I'm like, oh shit. So, yeah, it's exciting. And I am grateful to these big names for standing next to youth activists, because they raise our platform, our stories, our voices, our demands. And we might not agree on everything, but sharing platform when you have one is such an important responsibility that I also feel now that I have a bigger platform to share the stories of other activists and to help them get connected whenever I can or tap into new networks.
That's amazing. I agree. I think that since kind of being in and focusing more on environmentalism, maybe this is just like a Los Angeles problem, but like I've r only recently started to meet people that are also in this like realm, this world in Los Angeles, and I'm like, where have you been for the last 4 years? And they're like, where have you been for the last 4 years? And I'm like, I don't know. So I think I have just been making, friends and like loving to see. And oftentimes I'll find someone speaking or see something posted on social media, and that's how I'll learn about this new activist or this other advocate that I'd never heard of before. And so it's been like a journey. I feel like I'm getting so much more into it recently, like not into it in terms of like, oh, I all of a sudden just decided I was going to save the planet one day, into it. And like, I've been meeting more people that are also passionate about this. And so that's been like a fun journey of being able to find similar people that share values. And so I think it's great, like bringing voices to other advocates and activists, and it's incredible. It's how we share this movement and, get more people to join it. That's really incredible. And congratulations on speaking with big names like that. I think that you are in yourself considered a big name. Anyways, some topics that you cover, which we've talked a little bit about, include climate justice activism, Indigenous and immigrant visibility, and the power of Gen Z. So, is there one that maybe you're most drawn to, or that you can maybe just tell us a little bit more about?
Because I'm in school right now, I'm in my last semester of college.
Me too.
And I really see a difference between when I'm in school reading all of these papers versus when I'm in summer break or vacation. And the value of always learning and being a good communicator, let me reframe it like this. Being a good communicator directly depends on how much you are willing to learn and how much you're willing to think about and think through. And when I'm in school, I just feel like I have all of these data and stories at the top of my brain, and I have taken every climate class imaginable. I take physics of global warming and energy and environmental economics and environmental policy and environmental humanities and environmental justice writing seminar, like every single thing that had environment or climate in it, I took it. That gives me the ability to come into almost any single room and topic and be able to connect it to climate, which is a skill. You can tell me anything and I'll be like, this is how it connects to climate. And because of that, I think I can basically cover these topics that you mentioned in depth because I am making sure that my education is one that is multidisciplinary. And that is what we want the climate movement to be, not just put into this little box of environmentalism where people think that conservation is the only solution to climate crisis and ecological collapse. That's not it. We need to truly think about how we incorporate a new thinking into everything. How do we have climate architecture? How do we have cities that are built to sustain floods, or we have to move them all together, or etc.? I'm just trying to practice what I want the movement to be and all of us to be, which is people ha that can think across all disciplines. So I can talk, I have stats about a lot of different things, and I can talk about a lot of stuff.
Well, I think that whenever someone's like, oh, well, what's your, tips for someone that's joining this? What's your tips for someone who's like trying to get more into sustainability? And I'm always like, I think the first and foremost, most important thing to do is to educate yourself on it. Kind of like find things that you're interested in. So personally, like I have always been into fashion. I go to a fashion institute, like fashion is my passion. But that was the avenue where I wanted to focus on because it was something that I loved. It was something that I was wanting to study and be a part of that industry? And then how can I take that passion and that interest and find a way to make it better for not only our planet, but ourselves and the people that create our clothes, the people that work in the industry? And so that was like my avenue of getting into this world. Or I don't eat meat. I've been a vegetarian for all of my life at this point. I don't remember the last time I had meat, but I just never really liked meat. I thought it was gross. That was like a personal thing. And I just became a vegetarian. And I realized later in life, once I educated myself, how much of an impact me not eating meat was helping our planet. And so those were two avenues where I felt like I could change. I could educate myself on these two topics. And now that I've educated myself on those two topics, and obviously there's more to learn every single day, I'm not like 100%, I know every single thing about this thing. There's always going to be more to know. But now that I've learned more about these topics, I want to become more well-rounded in my environmental education. And so maybe I'll move on to another field that interests me. But I think it's finding the things that interest you and just changing one of them at a time, because I think it can be a little intimidating to come in and be like, I need to learn everything about how to save the planet right now. And so it's like, pick something that you're fascinated on, pick something that you already focus on, and become educated on it. And then once you feel like you know enough about the topic, educating others on it. I think that's such a first important step to take, because how can you take the other steps if you don't know what you're doing and if you don't know the impact you are having? And then sharing that, whether it's on social media or coming home and telling your spouse or your parents or your cousins or your friends, like whoever, and telling them about it, because that's, sharing this wealth of knowledge that you just got.
Yeah. So there's a scientist who's a scientist on climate communication. And she says the most important thing we can do about climate change is talk about it. And we just need that cultural shift, because talking about climate today, like not in my world, but I can see my peers and I can see like my friends. And talking about climate change is, you don't do it often. Like sometimes I'm in the subway or I'm just like, walking in a supermarket or whatever. And if I hear somebody talk about climate change, I'll get excited. I'm like, yeah, finally, like they're talking about it. But it shouldn't be like that, right? It should be that cultural shift that we are comfortable sharing all of these different perspectives so we can talk about nuance and not just like climate change as this general topic. It has to be, did you hear that? The new lithium mine they want to build is going to displace this community. Like that, those are the type of nuanced topics we need to talk about so that we are actually focusing on the best solutions and the transition rather than did we check the box of saying climate change, you know?
Well, I think that's the same thing as I honestly dislike the word sustainability, because I'm like, it just is, in terms of the fashion industry, is like such a broad term. And so it's like similar with like climate change. It's like there's so many boxes to check, and like you can't be sustainable if you're not also ethical and if people's basic needs aren't being met. And so there's all of these boxes. We just need to find a better word, but in the meantime, we have these ones.
I mean, I think, yeah, I totally agree. Because sustainability is like a flat term. It doesn't mean anything anymore. What I've been using is we need, instead of a sustainable economy or sustainable development, we need a regenerative economy. We need regenerative development. And if we, especially me, I don't know how people might perceive it, but when I think of it as regeneration, what I'm thinking is we have done damage, we need to fix it, and we need to stop doing the damage again. So that goes into, I don't know, kind of like a reinvention of the system.
I love that word. There we go. Found the new word.
Yeah,
Genuinely so helpful, because I'm like, I don't like using the word sustainability. And I've had so many conversations with people that are like, it's like when we used to say like vegan. And then I'm like, now vegan's like just a way that a lot of fashion brands like greenwash, because it's still out
it's just
of
plastic. Like, what do you
plastic. And
mean?
I'm
Like,
like, no.
like, imagine if you started talking about regenerative fashion and you
Right.
said instead of sustainable fashion, even like the way that your brain thinks about regenerative fashion, when you hear that at first, you think, well, the working conditions are more equitable and the materials that you use are helping the planet and the life cycle of the garment is different. So changing language is such a powerful tool to make
Important.
us think differently.
I could not agree more. Okay, so we are definitely cutting it close on time. So I will wrap this up. But where can people find you on social media to get in touch with you?
You can find me on most platforms, Shia Bastida, Xiye Bastida. On Instagram, I'm Shia Beata. Beata is my middle name. It means mermaid
Aww.
in
What a
Celtic.
full circle podcast moment. I love that.
And you can also find me on my website, shiabeata.com, and follow ReEarth Initiative, my nonprofit, for any information regarding international climate negotiations, how you can get involved, and find a group, organize.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. And while you're at it, you can follow me on my socials. My Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube are all at Lexi Silverstein. My name, that's Lexy, silver like the color, Stein. And remember to make the ordinary extraordinary.